From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Lydon. This episode, in Providence, Rhode Island, the Superman skyscraper is now empty.
Yep, everybody's asking what's going to happen to the Superman building.
And also, where are all the jobs? Our cover story, Rhode Island tries to find its way forward. Also, why the unpaid internship craze is a college grad's dilemma.
The internship has become virtually a requirement for getting into the white-collar workforce.
And then why German is the language that Texas struggles to hold on to. A conversation with writer Claire Massoud. And how a 1965 American novel called Stoner became a European bestseller today.
Even as he sets the scene in Columbia, Missouri, at the same time, it could be anywhere.
Plus, a conversation with Amanda Knox.
There was a lot of fantasy projected onto me, and that resulted in a reappropriation and recharacterization of who I am.
And Deke Sharon, a cappella king of sing-off and Pitch Perfect, teaches me to beatbox.
Go.
That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. We'll start out the show this week in another part of the country, Rhode Island. This small New England state is home to beautiful beaches, top-notch universities, and a thriving arts scene. But beneath the surface, Rhode Island is an example of what states all over the country are facing: shrinking revenues, lost jobs, and general economic malaise. In Rhode Island's capital city, Providence, the issue has come to a head around the future of a once iconic building. That's our cover story today. A look at the Rhode Island economy through the windows of the tallest building in Providence, the now vacant Industrial Trust Tower, also known as the Superman Building.
We're standing right in front of the Industrial Trust Tower in the heart of Kennedy Plaza.
Bill Fisher is the spokesperson for High Rock Development, which took ownership of this Providence landmark on May 1st and presented a controversial proposal to turn it into luxury apartments. And taxpayers are being asked to fund the project. The building is empty now for the first time in 85 years, and that casts a shadow over a city struggling to reinvent its economy. Standing with Fisher on the front sidewalk, I can almost feel the tension over the future of the affectionately named Superman Building. When did it become known as the Superman Building?
Some of us who are a little older remember the 1950s original Superman TV series.
Faster than a speeding bullet.
And at the beginning of that show, they had him leaping buildings with a single bound.
Able to leap tall buildings at a single
bound. They had an image of a building that was very similar to this. It was not this building, but people thought it was for a while.
Yes, it's Superman.
And the name caught on, the Superman Building, and it's part of the Rhode Island lexicon, I guess, as they say. Things like that stick in Rhode Island.
When you buy the tallest, most prominent, and instantly recognizable property in town, suddenly everyone has an opinion about its future.
Yep, it's kind of the buzz around here right now. Yep, everybody's asking what's going to happen to the Superman Building.
A security guard posted outside didn't want us to use his full name. With the Rhode Island unemployment rate at 9.1%, who can blame him? But standing under the Superman Building day after day, Bill hears a lot of the debate going on downtown.
So hopefully they'll do the right thing, and what that is, I don't know. They're talking apartments. You know, I don't know if we need any more apartments downtown. Some people say yes, some people say no.
On April 30th, High Rock Development presented their demands. Here's what they asked for: $39 million of unspecified assistance from the state of Rhode Island, $10 to $15 million in tax breaks from the city of Providence. So for a grand total of $54 million from the state and city combined, Providence will get a couple hundred high-end apartments. Taxpayers go back and forth over whether that's a good investment.
I don't think that's a good idea, apartments. They should turn it into something that's going to help get more jobs out there for the people. That's about it.
They're trying to borrow money from the state. The state needs it. Look at all the people that's homeless.
Yeah, as long as they make it equal housing and low income, go ahead, do the thing. Do it. You know, housing is what we need, but we need low income housing. You know, not any more luxury apartments.
I think it should be turned into those condos, but I don't see where the city right now can come up with the money to help them fund it.
We just heard from Rhode Islanders Wendy Bolero, Roger Isley, Sandra Theus, and Frank P. Vieira as they waited for buses at the depot across from the Superman Building. But I wanted to go inside.
This, we're walking right now into the bank lobby, or what was the bank lobby.
Bill Fisher, spokesman for the development company, took us inside the dusty, cavernous main hall, where up to a month ago, residents could come in and cash a check. Now, it's deserted.
This is my first time back in the building since the bank closure on April 20th. And when I was here, there was a hustle and bustle of bank tellers and employees and customers. The pens are still in the slots. I mean, and so to stand here today, it's a bit eerie in here, and it's kind of sad.
Let's think of it this way. This building is Rhode Island's Empire State Building. This isn't a purely economic decision for the city and state. There's huge emotional attachment to this 1927 Art Deco skyscraper. Do you think the city, let me put this gently,
yeah.
Do you have them over the barrel?
No. How gentle was that? Look, we have great respect for Mayor Tavares and his team. Yeah, we want the city and the state to be a partner in this, but it needs to be viewed from a unique perspective, because the alternative is we flood the market with Class B office space, or we mothball it for a while. And that's not some sort of political or retaliatory tactic. It's a sound real estate tactic.
I asked Fisher if that building wouldn't better serve the people of Rhode Island as an office building, attracting a business to bring jobs downtown.
We think adding 450 residents to downtown Providence can change the direction of the city. We're talking about, you know, annual spending just in sales tax alone from those residents, so totaling $26 million. So there's real economic impacts if they're willing to make the investment and if they're willing to think long term.
For this particular investment, there's far more at stake than just money, because Rhode Island is still feeling burned from a previous debacle that attracted national attention. In 2010, former Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling asked Rhode Island for a $75 million loan to start a video game company in Providence. Schilling came to the state after Massachusetts had turned him down for the funding. He promised Rhode Island hundreds of jobs, and the hope was that a successful tech company would draw more business to the state. So Schilling got almost everything he asked for. He was a local sports hero, but not experienced with tech startups, which some say should have been a red flag. Last year, 38 studios went bankrupt, and Rhode Island was left with the bill.
Eventually, they defaulted on the bonds and they went belly up. So now, instead of really trying to make our economy better, the debate is, should we allow those bonds to default?
Len Lodaro is an economist at the University of Rhode Island, and he's one of the go-to guys for an analysis of the state's economy. Lodaro wasn't surprised when 38 studios declared bankruptcy last year.
This was something that was supposed to be a real game changer to give Rhode Island a major presence in the gaming industry.
And Lodaro worries that the state is in for a second round of defaulted loans if they rashly support redevelopment of the Superman building.
Well, let's see how well or how badly run the city and state are. Because if they get major concessions of the magnitude they're looking for, then Rhode Island will have earned its lagging status.
Maybe Len Lodaro doesn't need to worry so much. This time around, state and city representatives have been openly critical of High Rock's proposal.
A city is more than a building.
In Providence, Mayor Angel Tavares seems determined not to let his city make the same mistake twice.
If you are asking for governmental support, you certainly need to look at all possibilities. Certainly I will as mayor.
The Superman building is hard to ignore from his ornate City Hall office with direct views of the imposing tower from every window. But Tavares is hesitant to endorse High Rock's proposal until he has more information.
We will figure out what we can reasonably do to be helpful, and also the market will dictate some things as well. But I believe it's going to be a symbol of renewal, and I look forward to that.
And in the meantime, Mayor Angel Tavares has bigger issues to address.
The challenges we face as a city are similar to challenges that cities face across the country, and that is getting as many people back to work as possible. We need to increase the pace of employment.
They don't want to send down a lot of friends, they just want to disappear.
Yeah, this is working good.
Even on the state's gorgeous beaches, the stress of long-term unemployment is a constant presence.
My name is David Kitchens. I'm 53, and I have a bachelor's degree in physics. And what I'm doing here as part of a FEMA grant is doing beach restoration and cleanup from the Hurricane Sandy.
Kitchens tells us that usually there are 8 men working on East Matunuck State Beach, but today there are only 4. All these men are long-term unemployed veterans, and they've been working since spring, shoveling sand from the beach pavilion and the parking lots.
Old-time honest labor.
Today, Kitchens and his team are putting up a fence to preserve the fragile sand dunes. Rhode Island has the highest unemployment in New England and the 6th highest unemployment in the entire country, 9.1%.
The economic situation in Rhode Island, at the time that I got this job, it was still over 10% unemployment. So, you know, after 150 resumes and some 25 or 30 different interviews, this finally came along.
Working with Kitchens is John Douglas. He's been job hunting for 3 years and is grateful for this temporary gig, even though it's coming to an end in June.
I was in the construction, mining industry, and with the economy hitting the skids with home building and stuff, it really fell right off. It started to come back now a little bit, so hopefully things will change. But right now, this is very good. This is good work. Get to go to the beach every day.
A lot of the people we spoke with were optimistic for the future of their state. But not far from the beach where David Kitchens and his crew are cleaning up, economist Len Lodaro at the University of Rhode Island studies his charts and worries that if the city and state mishandle the Superman building, it will derail economic progress again.
I think that the national thing to learn from our handling of the Superman building is don't get too tied to the past. You've got to always look at the best possible use going forward, not looking back. And you don't do that by being nostalgic with your money.
And in such a beautiful 19th century city, saturated with history, forward momentum is what Providence and the state of Rhode Island need to pull out of the recession slump. Even so, all eyes are on the Superman building and its bright green beacon that casts a constant light over the nighttime cityscape for now. Coming up, another reading from our 3-minute fiction series, and a cappella aficionado Deke Sharon shows me how to beatbox. You don't want to miss that, so stay tuned. This is NPR News. Summer's almost here, and with it comes the army of interns who will turn up in countless American workplaces. It can be a boon for the inexperienced, but more and more, interns are growing restless that they're being exploited. Increasingly, interns have been willing to push back. Some have even sued. This week, one of those cases suffered a setback when a judge in New York ruled that a group of 3,000 former interns could not pursue a lawsuit against the Hearst Corporation as a class action. They would each have to sue the company as individuals. To understand what this means for interns, we turn to Ross Perlin. He's the author of Intern Nation, How to Earn Nothing and Learn Little in the Brave New Economy. Welcome to the show, Ross.
Thanks for having me on the show, Jackie.
Bit of a cynical title.
Well, perhaps, but I think it's also just kind of a reality that the internship has become virtually a requirement for getting into the white-collar workforce, certainly. It's something that the majority of students at 4-year colleges do at least once before they graduate. Many do it 2, 3, 4 or more times. An estimated quarter or third of all internships are unpaid. Many more are low-paid as well. So those are the ones we're really focusing on.
So, Ross, take us into some where these extended unpaid internships have become contentious.
The 5 lawsuits that have been filed encompass the one you've mentioned, Jackie, involving Hearst, and that's a fashion and kind of media internship. You're looking at Elite Model Management is kind of the last of these lawsuits to have been filed, an internship involving sports and kind of sports management stuff. There is the first of these lawsuits involving the Black Swan film with Fox Searchlight Pictures. There's a film that made $300 million, had many unpaid interns working on it, doing very fundamental work like keeping the books, and they were unpaid, and this is a widespread problem in the world of film. The Black Swan case, as I understand, they are going through this process of ensuring that it's going to be certified as a class, all the interns who are involved, and I should say that this decision on the Hearst case also about whether or not all the interns who worked there can be considered a class, it is a setback in the sense that it becomes harder for groups of interns to kind of get together, and it makes it less likely that lawyers will take those cases. Hmm. One of these cases has been settled already. That involved the Charlie Rose program, mm-hmm. and that was settled not long ago for, I believe, $250,000. So That one is not setting any kind of precedent, but at least the interns are going to see some of their wages at last.
But let's take Black Swan or Hearst. You can make the argument that this looks great on the resume. Why should interns expect to have rights in the workplace?
I think there are a lot of reasons why interns should have rights in the way that other workers do. I think it's particularly as internships have become a kind of broken signal, as those opportunities were not there at the end of the hard work, that people realize that this sort of informal bargain was already being sort of broken, and that people were having to do more and more internships to get there. And then even at that point, they were going to be left doing precarious forms of labor as freelancers and temps and other things.
So I'm sure by now we've thoroughly bummed out people seeking internships. Any red flags that people should look for?
Well, first, I should say that, of course, there are really good internships out there. In terms of red flags, in terms of identifying problematic internships from the start, in general, any for-profit company that's advertising an unpaid internship, you have to look at it very carefully. So it has to be clear that they understand that it's really a training program. If they're asking, you know, for somebody who has deep experience with Photoshop, can design websites, and, you know, has lots of other experience, and then they're saying, oh, sorry, we're actually not going to be able to pay. And by the way, you know, we'll give you some school credit. That also should raise a red flag, because school credit is given out by schools. And that really should not come into play unless there is a real relationship that's been built between the employer and a given college.
Ross Perlin is the author of Intern Nation, How to Earn Nothing and Learn Little in the Brave New Economy. Ross, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Jackie.
It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. Coming up, why did a book that flopped almost 50 years ago recently hit the bestseller charts in Europe? But first, a pair of stories about language, one that's disappearing and one that never tripped off the tongue in the first place. Let's start in Texas, where you might know the accent, but I bet you've never heard it like this before.
Viele Leute haben mich gesagt, warum lernt ihr die Kinder Deutsch? Das brauchen die ja doch nie.
Now that's German, but a particular variant of German, Texas German, and it's almost extinct. Professor Hans Boas at the University of Texas has been archiving the few remaining speakers he can find for his Texas German Dialect Project. Back in the 1840s, a large wave of German speakers settled in central Texas just after the young republic gained independence from Mexico.
And by the mid-1850s, New Braunfels was already the third largest town in Texas. It was exclusively German-speaking. And most of the hill country throughout the 1860s, 1870s, and 1880s developed into an almost exclusive German-speaking area.
So Texas German, how different is it than other German dialects that have developed in other parts of the United States, like the German spoken by the Amish, for example?
It is a very different dialect. The German spoken by the Amish was brought much earlier, already in the 17th century, and it has only one or at the most two specific donor dialects. Texas German is a dialect that consists of at least 5 to 6 very different German dialects.
Did they come up with words for the New World that developed neither German nor English, something that wouldn't be understood back in Germany?
They came up with a number of different words. The most prominent is perhaps the word Stinkkatze, which means stinking cat, which is skunk in English. These animals don't exist in Europe. On top of that, you will find nouns like carburetor, fence, verbs like to move, to drink. You get words like well and you know. Or you get these mixed discourse markers like was ever, which is whatever in Texas English.
Wow. Let's sample one of your interviews with a fellow from Crawford, Texas, which became famous, of course, as George W. Bush's home away from the White House. That's just between Dallas and Austin. Let's listen to this clip from Crawford.
Grunde Wiese, das war ein kleiner Stadt. Ich habe niemand gefunden, das ist familiar with that. Like when ich habe deutschen Krieg gefangen, waren ein oder zwei von die ask question.
This gentleman seems kind of rusty.
What you hear here is really typical of, I would say, the standard speaker of Texas German today, who's in his or her 70s. It's a mix of English and German. It's halted speech. In a lot of cases, these people have not spoken any Texas German in 10, 20, sometimes in 30 years. So when they, for the first time, have the opportunity to speak it again, they have problems remembering many words. They will either halt, they will pause, they will say a few words in English, and then they will go back to Texas German and back to English and back and forth.
I understand that during World Wars I and II, when the U.S. was fighting, it was kind of tough for these people.
Yes, exactly. World War I was really the first big loss for Texas German. What happened was in 1918 was a law passed that prescribed English as the only language of instruction in the schools. As a result of that, the kids were told that being German or speaking German or having a German name was un-American, was unpatriotic. And as a result of that, parents decided not to teach their kids any more German because they didn't want their kids to have any disadvantage.
And yet you yourself met people who spoke this dialect. Somebody must still be speaking it. I understand that it's down to about 8,000 German Texas speakers these days. When do you think that the language, which is vulnerable, might be gone for good?
I would give it about another 20 to 30 years. So once that last speaker of Texas German is gone, the dialect will be gone, and there's no chance to record it or archive or study it anymore.
Hans Boas teaches Germanic studies at the University of Texas in Austin, and that's where he leads the Texas German Dialect Project. And he joined us from Erfurt, Germany. Very nice to talk to you. Danke.
Thanks so much for having me on. Danke. Auf Wiedersehen.
Now another story about something long forgotten, except this one is about a revival. For the past 2 months, The Tale has been the number one novel in the Netherlands, a bestseller across much of Europe. And we're not talking about Dan Brown's latest page-turner or salacious tell-alls or steamy romances. No. The book that's riveted readers worldwide is a quiet, slim novel about a young man who leaves a hardscrabble farm in Missouri to become a literature professor in 1910. Stoner, named for its protagonist, was originally published in 1965 and then almost immediately forgotten.
It got an admiring reception, but it didn't have great sales.
That's Edwin Frank, an editor with the New York Review of Books. 1965's bestseller list was filled with sprawling classics like The Source, the James A. Michener novelized history of Judaism, and Saul Bellow's Herzog. The other big titles were thrillers, John le Carré, James Bond, whereas author John Williams' novel was neither. Stoner is the story of a Missouri man's outwardly uneventful life.
It tells about his career, it tells about his marriage, it tells about a love affair he has, and it tells finally about his death. And in doing so, it sort of pays tribute to a man whose life is in one sense utterly ordinary, but in another sense rich as anyone's life can be.
Unfortunately, Edwin Frank says, Americans weren't drawn to this sort of Sinclair Lewis style in the mid-1960s.
That kind of realism was not in any sense fashionable at that point.
The only publication to mention the book at all was The New Yorker in their briefly noted column. Stoner sold a meager 2,000 copies and quickly fell out of print. And its author, John Williams, passed away in 1994. Similarly admired but obscure, forgotten to all but a few aficionados. Like a bookseller on the Upper East Side, a friend of Edwin Frank's.
Who knew the book and loved the book, but found that it was next to impossible to get a hold of.
Edwin Frank is in the business of forgotten but great novels. He runs the New York Review of Books Classics. He republished Stoner in 2006. Like many of their titles, it was reviewed well and sold modestly at first, until Anna Gavalda bought one of the copies. She's one of France's best-selling novelists. She had to read Stoner in English. There wasn't a French translation, and despite the language difference, she says she felt a deep connection with the book.
Je pense que c'est un livre que j'aurais pu écrire.
I think it's a book I could have written myself because I feel really close to the author and the narrator, who, in my opinion, are probably a bit of the same person.
Gavalda says the book is not just for people who love to read.
But it's for people who need to read, for whom reading is vital. It's for people who can't live without books, culture, and knowledge.
Gavalda liked it so much that she asked her editor to buy the rights. She wanted to translate it herself. And now that the book is selling so well in Europe, she couldn't be happier.
My books sell really well in France, so when all the other European editors saw that it was me who translated this book, they were all curious about why Anna Gavalda translated it. And so they all bought the rights. So yes, I'm really proud of that. It's perhaps my proudest achievement.
Back in New York, Edwin Frank can only watch and speculate as to why Stoner has so moved European readers like Anna Gavalda.
Resonates, I think, partly because of the art with which the story has been told. So even as he sets the scene in Columbia, Missouri, at the same time, it could be anywhere.
And two, there's a fitting ironic twist. In the novel, the memory of John Williams' protagonist also fades with time.
An occasional student who comes upon the name may wonder idly who William Stoner was, but he seldom pursues his curiosity beyond a casual question. Stoner's colleagues, who held him in no particular esteem when he was alive, speak of him rarely now.
Stoner the man was overlooked. Not so with Stoner the novel, Edwin Frank says.
I don't know that anybody says quite as beautifully as Morris Dickstein when he did it in the Times. It's something much rarer than a great book. It's a perfect book.
It's a pity, Frank admits, that Stoner was so neglected during author John Williams' lifetime. But with true classics, sometimes you need distance to appreciate the endurance. You can read an excerpt of John Williams' Stoner on our website at npr.org. In Claire Massoud's latest novel, The Woman Upstairs, she presents a protagonist who might at first seem to be the anti-heroine, an elementary school teacher whose desires to be an artist have been suppressed in the service of sensibility. Suppressed, but not doused. Nora Eldridge, the 37-year-old teacher, is still smoldering, and the embers are stirred by the presence of another woman, a whole family, actually, of foreigners, man, woman, and child, who present a magical way out, a banquet of experience. Suppressed artist meets a flamboyant, realized artist, and art, selfhood, and what is real and what is stolen gets played out against a complicated web of human relationships with Nora at the center. Claire Massoud is the author, and Claire Massoud, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jackie. Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. So tell us a little bit more about the woman upstairs, as you call Nora Eldridge. Maybe you could tell us why you call her that.
Well, she calls herself that. It's in part a response to existing ranting misfit narrators, the granddaddy of them being Dostoevsky's underground man. And of course, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man was a response to Dostoevsky. But there aren't many ranting women. So Nora is a ranting woman who is, you wouldn't, meeting Nora, think of her as a misfit, but her interior life is roiling.
Why don't we meet her? Please read us a little bit in her voice, would you?
Sure. How angry am I? You don't want to know. Nobody wants to know about that. I'm a good girl. I'm a nice girl. I'm a straight-A, straight-laced, good daughter, good career girl, and I never stole anybody's boyfriend, and I never ran out on a girlfriend, and I put up with my parents' shit and my brother's shit, and I'm not a girl anyhow. I'm over 40 years old, and I'm good at my job, and I'm great with kids, and I held my mother's hand when she died after 4 years of holding her hand while she was dying, and I speak to my father every day on the telephone, every day, mind you, and what kind of weather do you have on your side of the river, because here it's pretty gray and a bit muggy, too. It was supposed to say great artist on my tombstone, but if I died right now, it would say such a good teacher, daughter, friend instead. And what I really want to shout and want in big letters on that grave, too, is F you all.
You know, there's something in her passion which is so attractive. Let's talk a little bit about the storyline. We have here Nora, a school teacher. You know, there was part of her, though, Claire, that I thought I didn't understand in the sense of the self-abnegation. Seemed a bit of a throwback to me. She's not, never mind about not being married. She's decided not to go to art school. And right now, we have such an emphasis in American culture that all your talents should be realized as early as possible. How did it happen that she neglected her talent?
One of the things that I wanted to write about is the generation which is mine. My mother was perhaps, I mean, she was absolutely a feminist in her heart, but by 1970, when The Female Eunuch was published and Ms. Magazine came out, she was a 37-year-old mother with two children who had been following her husband's career. And the idea that she could realize her dreams was not possible. So it was something that was very much instilled in me by my mother, that I needed to be financially independent. And so for Nora, she has a similar message from her mother, and you can't necessarily earn a living being an artist.
So she's missed this message that you can have it all. She is actually pretty responsible. And then along comes her foil, this amazing artist called Serena. Tell us about her.
Serena is on the cusp of broader success, which is something that happens to her after the year she spends in Cambridge. And she has a husband and a child, but she's able to put her art, if not first, then certainly equal with her other responsibilities. And over the course of the year, she's preparing for a show. And as the time for the show approaches, she puts her art first before everything else.
Eventually, Serena is able to sort of spellbind Nora into helping her in all kinds of ways. Boundaries get crossed again and again, and Nora talks about that in this book.
Yes, there are things that she signs up for willingly that even as she does so, part of her recognizes, you know, this is a bad choice. I shouldn't do this. So one example would be babysitting outside school. It seemed to break a boundary that you didn't want broken, you know, to enter into the personal life of a family. But more than that, she agrees to do it without being paid. And she does that because it makes her feel like a relative, as though she's part of the family, which is something she wants desperately. But of course, the result is sort of terrible.
Claire Massoud, let me just get back to a point that we began with at the beginning of our talk, and that was you wanted to write an angry character. And it's interesting, you know, an angry female character. I can think of them almost more in fairy tales. What's going on here when it comes to angry female protagonists in literature?
Well, I think women's anger is unacceptable. We live in a culture that wants to put a redemptive face on everything, so anger doesn't sit well with any of us. But I think women's anger sits less well than anything else. Women's anger is very, very scary to people. And to no one more than other women who think, oh, goodness, well, if I let the lid off, where would we be?
Without giving anything away, I will say it concludes with taking her own back. But still, when I think about the justification for her anger, it does make me want to go throw a pie or, you know, break a glass or something like that.
Well, I think you could, you know, there are lots of ways. My hope is that there are lots of ways to read it, and you can take it in all sorts of ways, I hope.
Claire Massoud's latest book is called The Woman Upstairs, and she joined us from member station KUOW in Seattle. Claire, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jackie.
When 20-year-old Amanda Knox left Seattle for Italy in 2007, it was supposed to be a carefree year studying abroad. No one could have foreseen it ending in her being accused, tried, and convicted for the murder of her roommate, Meredith Kircher, just weeks after she arrived. The case and Knox became an international media sensation.
American Amanda Knox returned to an Italian courtroom Monday.
Prosecutors aren't the only ones who don't buy Amanda Knox's claims of innocence.
Amanda Knox, the object of a worldwide mystery and tabloid sensation.
Knox and her former boyfriend, Rafael Sollecito, spent 4 years in prison following a controversial trial before an Italian court overturned their convictions. Now, 25-year-old Amanda Knox tells her own story in a memoir called Waiting to be Heard. She joined me from member station KUOW in Seattle to talk about it. I asked her to take me back to the young woman she was when she first left Washington State for Italy.
I wanted to go somewhere where I could come into my own without any ties and prove to myself that I could be an adult. I was definitely a very confident in very certain ways and then very insecure and immature, just like any 20-year-old who hasn't had the life experience to justify their confidence in themselves. So I was very young.
Let's go back to the day just after the murder of Meredith Kircher. It is November of 2007. You didn't know that you were a suspect. You didn't leave Perugia. You didn't call the American Embassy. Why didn't those things happen?
It never occurred to me to worry that I would be a suspect. I didn't do it. And I was very much making myself available to the police so that I could help. But what's important is I thought my innocence was obvious. And even when they were screaming at me in my interrogation and calling me a liar, like, I could not believe what was happening to me was happening. I very much did not understand the kind of danger that I was in?
One of the things that would turn out to be the most troublesome in the case against you, Amanda Knox, was this false confession that emanates from that time that you made about your boss, Patrick Lumumba. He's your boss at this late-night bar, Le Chic. How did that happen?
Yeah, that was something that I didn't understand how it could happen for a very, very long time. I had spent those days since the discovery of Meredith's body mostly in the police office, being questioned, repeating over and over what I saw. And that night that I finally broke down, there was a change in their behavior towards me. It wasn't about questions anymore. It was about saying to me that I was wrong, that I was lying. They told me that I had witnessed the murder, that I knew who the murderer was, and that I only couldn't remember. And the only explanation that made sense in that terrible, incredibly incomprehensible moment was what they were providing me, which was that I must have witnessed the murder, that the text message that I received from my boss meant that I had met him that night, and I believed them.
You would spend 4 years in Capane, the prison outside Perugia, fighting for your freedom. You and separately, Rafael Sollicita, you were sentenced to 26 years in prison. You learned Italian well enough to eventually defend yourself in your second trial, your appeal. Maybe you could relive for us the moment of your conviction being overturned in 2011.
After my conviction, I was devastated. I had never believed that I would be convicted. And so all of that time after my conviction leading up to my acquittal, I was afraid to hope. Not even my innocence had saved me. And so I was afraid that my innocence would never save me. I stood there quivering, and then they announced that I was innocent, and I was immediately freed. I remember going in the car back to Capane from the courthouse, and when I got back there, the entire prison erupted, and everyone started banging pots against the bars and waving T-shirts out of the windows, just screaming, "Libertà, libertà!" And it was overwhelming because I had imagined this, and I had imagined also the worst of never, ever leaving.
I want to turn to something else, perhaps less glorious to remember. Every detail of your sex life and details that were attributed to your sex life became front page news around the world. I'm wondering if you think that such a case might have been built in the same circumstances around a handsome young man who'd only been in Italy for 6 weeks.
I think a lot about what if I were a man, would it have been such a sensation throughout the world? Maybe not, but maybe I would have been suspected were I a man. Maybe I would have been suspected were I black or Asian or any other race besides white. I think the fact that my case was so sensationalized is because I am a white woman. And
one who was sexual and whose diary became part of the evidence used against her.
Exactly. I think that there was a lot of fantasy projected onto me, and that resulted in a reappropriation and recharacterization of who I am.
Your case, Amanda Knox, has now taken another turn. This past March, the Italian Supreme Court annulled this acquittal, and a new review of the case has been ordered. Do you feel that your name really hasn't been cleared now?
Oh, God, it's looming over me, this horrendous thing that just never ends. I do not think that I will be convicted, because there just simply is not that evidence. I just simply did not do it. I feel like I'm having to prove my innocence as opposed to have the prosecution prove my guilt. The only thing I can do is continue to defend myself, and I'm trying so hard to make understood at least the aspects of it that I did to contribute. I'm trying to help. I'm trying to explain. I'm not trying to excuse the wrong things I did, like accuse Patrick Lumumba. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I'm going to be dealing with this for the rest of my life. I don't.
That's Amanda Knox. Her new book is called Waiting to Be Heard. Amanda Knox, I really want to thank you for spending some time with us.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
And if you're just joining us, this is Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon, and it's time now for music.
Oh, you're an alien. Your touch so foreign. It's supernatural. It's extraterrestrial.
That's the group Pentatonix, winners of NBC's hit reality show competition, The Sing-Off, singing their a cappella version of Katy Perry's E.T. The days of doo-wops and barbershop may be gone, but a cappella is cool again. And it's all thanks to the father of contemporary a cappella, Deke Sharon. Sharon is vocal producer for The Sing-Off and the movie that brought a cappella to the big screen, Pitch Perfect. A cappella may mean performing without instruments, but in my conversation with Deke Sharon, he played a few.
A little muted trumpet. A little electric guitar.
You are phenomenal. I mean, I have this vision of you as a kid in the bedroom with this stuff, and I just want to say, where does it all come from?
Well, it is easy to say I was the kid in the back of the class making funny noises like Robin Williams, but I was actually the kid sitting in the front row, snotty and sucking up to the teacher. So these all of these sounds were developed slowly over time. I think all people who sing a cappella sing along with the radio, but they don't sing the melody. They sing the harmony, and then they start singing the guitar part, and they start making up drum sounds. And before you know it, there's no turning back.
With the success of your movie Pitch Perfect and the a cappella reality show, The Sing-Off, coming back for the fourth season, these kinds of groups have really found a whole new audience in recent years, haven't they?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, a cappella is the oldest music. And back 100 years ago, barbershop, that was just guys getting together singing current pop music. 50 years ago, doo-wop, the street corner thing, they were just singing current pop tunes. So what we're doing now is no different. The real difference is that we're able to use our voices in a number of new ways that are able to fill out the sound and really replicate the strong pounding rhythms and the full sonic spectrum, replicating instruments sometimes. Back in the day when the Whiff and Poofs were started at Yale, collegiate a cappella was four-part singing. Now if you've got 14 guys, you're going to have 14 different parts sometimes, and you can really replicate a current pop song, which is electrifying for an audience.
What about for you? Where did it catch fire?
For me, it was experiential. Some of it came from singing around the campfire and hearing one of the counselors improvise harmonies. When the Tufts Beelzebubs came and sang at my high school, I was captivated. I just loved the energy and the excitement of the sound that came from them on stage. But when I was in college and I started directing the Tufts Beelzebubs, I wanted to sing the current pop songs on the radio. And it just didn't work with shooby-doo-wop and ooh and ah and lyrics. So we needed to add the vocal percussion, and we needed to create different instrumental sounds to make that come alive and work for the audiences. And then we were off to the races.
You know what I was thinking in your movie, Pitch Perfect? I'm looking at the riff-off. And I'm thinking, as the women are singing, that it's, maybe this is crazy, sort of a female updated version of The Sharks and the Jets. I mean, I hear in my brain something that links back to West Side Story, only this time everybody's singing. And they're
absolutely
chicks.
Absolutely. And the excitement of that scene, although frankly it's almost impossible to do live. I'll let you know that you shouldn't be expecting collegiate a cappella groups to be doing that in empty swimming pools around the nation spontaneously. But the drama of that scene comes from the fact that you don't expect women to be singing this kind of full, rich, powerful a cappella. That's one of the things that contemporary a cappella has really brought to the forefront, having women be every bit the counterpart of men.
You were the vocal producer for Pitch Perfect, and you helped arrange this song. Let's listen to the Bellas sing here. I've been singing this all day now.
You and 13-year-old girls around the world.
Oh, there's a lot of 13-year-old girls in there. I understand you had nine actresses for this performance, and some of them had never sung a cappella before. Tell me how you rehearsed them for this movie.
That's correct. Well, we had set aside, Jason Moore, the fantastic director of this movie, set aside a month of a cappella boot camp, he called it. And so I got together on that first day. We had one singer, Kelly Jekyll, who was in two seasons of The Sing-Off as our kind of ringer. And then nine actresses, most of whom had maybe had a little bit of, oh, I sang in chorus in middle school. Let me tell you, after that first day, I went home and I didn't sleep too much. I thought, can we do this? Is this going to be possible? But they really stepped up. I mean, Shelley, who did vocal percussion, there was nobody who had done any. And I just had to ask, so who wants to learn how to beatbox? And she kind of sheepishly raised her hand. I was like, okay, let's do this. Let's go. And we just put them all on a crash course and they really rose to the occasion.
So this is the percussion we're hearing, because people might be thinking, oh, they've added some drums or something like that. No, mm-mm. This is absolutely mm-mm. things you're doing with your mouth. Can you teach me how to beatbox?
Well, yeah, I'll give you a little bit. The easiest one is a hi-hat. It's just a T sound. Just say like that. Perfect. Keep doing it. So you can use an open hi-hat sound, but breathe in. Do you hear the difference?
Yeah, like the little hi-hat.
Right, so you can go. Exactly. And then kick drums underneath that. You could say boots and cats and boots and cats, but then
boots
turn that
and
into
cats and boots. And then
right,
it turns into
boots and cats and boots and cats. There you go. There you go. Day one, you're ready for a cappella boot camp. Done.
Wow. This is so much fun. You know, there had to be a time, though, when if you told your friends that this is what you wanted to do, I can just imagine it landing just with a huge thud, you know.
A huge thud. In fact, my high school choral director wouldn't say this to my face, but I learned afterwards. He said, basically, you graduated college, and it's as though you said, I love tiddlywinks, so I want to create a professional tiddlywink circuit and tiddlywink competitions, tiddlywink nonprofit. And then 10 years later, he said, I guess it worked out for you in the tiddlywinks thing. So it was, I bet my life, a huge risk. And it has paid off handsomely and been a wonderful journey. You got it.
Just think about
Done.
That, okay?
Done. Just get a couple of your friends together, and I'll see you in New York this weekend for casting.
The All Things Considered Weekend Acapella Group. I think we can work on that. Deke Sharon, it has been so much fun to talk to you. Thank you.
A pleasure. Thank you.
And for the week ending May 19th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Becky Sullivan, Liz Baker, Amy Held, Lily Percy, and Connor Donovan. Our intern is Rachel Rude. The technical director is Daniel Shukin. Mathoni Maturi is senior editor. And Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Jackie Leiden. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.
Excuse me, but I might take a little more pressure tonight.